This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak about homelessness. It's an epidemic in the United States, with little or no governmental efforts to solve this human crisis.
Our guest today is Patrick McKee, a scholar on how we've gotten to this sorry state of affairs and what it will take to reverse course and end this shameful situation. Next on Law and Disorder, as the Trump administration continues to punish faculty and students who dare to protest Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, academic freedom is on the chopping block.
Our guest today is Professor Emeritus Alan Wald from the University of Michigan, who challenges the validity of the charge of anti-Semitism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Homelessness in the USA has reached catastrophic proportions. In New York City alone, 125,000 people are homeless. One out of every 8 children in public school are homeless. Shelters for homeless people are overflowing. Many sleep outside or in the subway system. Their conditions of life have driven many of these people over the edge. The problem is longstanding and quite evident. There's a lack of affordable housing. Why? Because building affordable housing is not as profitable as building luxury housing. How realistic is it to get money for affordable housing when the oligarchy in power lacks empathy and only seeks to enrich itself, shift money from the bottom to the top, and poor people have very little political clout in the two-party system? We speak today with Patrick McKee. He's a prominent advocate and policy analyst known for his extensive work on homelessness in New York City. He worked at the Coalition for the Homeless for several decades. McKee's forthcoming book, Placeless, Homelessness in the New Gilded Age, pinpoints systemic factors such as economic inequality, housing affordability, and policy decisions that have perpetuated homelessness since the administration of Ronald Reagan some 40 years ago. Patrick McKee, a very hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael, and thank you so much for having me on the program.
Patrick, how did you get involved as an advocate for the homeless?
Well, you know, I'm actually one of those, dwindling few Americans who grew up in a period before modern mass homelessness began. So my childhood in the 1970s, there were actually remarkably few homeless people. In the city that I grew up in, Cleveland, Ohio, despite the economic problems that was going on in the city there, one rarely, if ever, encountered homeless people sleeping on the streets. But when I went to college in Boston in the early 1980s and then later moved to New York, the problem was inescapable and palpable and just overwhelming. I was just immediately struck in the early 80s and then throughout the rest of that decade with the just staggering numbers of people sleeping out in the streets and subway system and other public spaces. And then in the early 1990s, I was lucky enough to begin working first as a volunteer and then later, you know, professionally in homeless shelters. And finally, in the mid-1990s, with the Coalition for the Homeless, which is the leading advocacy organization for homeless people in New York City.
Well, Patrick, there are in New York City upwards of 125,000 homeless people now. What policies of Mayor Eric Adams have, well, perpetuated this or allowed this to happen? And the same question as it refers to their predecessors, the liberal Bill de Blasio and the billionaire Mike Bloomberg. What political forces are at play that led to this?
You know, it's a huge question to answer. I'll try and sort of like boil it down this way. It's not so much about Adams as just he's the sort of latest inheritor of a broken policy regime of kind of neoliberal policymaking that really began coming out of the fiscal crisis in New York City in the 1970s and was really pioneered by Ed Koch and then, you know, subsequent mayors following after him. Essentially a policy that involved dramatic cutbacks in public spending, especially in programs assisting the poorest New Yorkers and working class New Yorkers. At the same time, you know, kind of tax benefits and tax giveaways for corporations and wealthy people. And obviously the sort of workshopping of that model in New York City during the fiscal crisis was then taken to the national level by Reagan in the 1980s, and then, you know, obviously and internationally in other countries as well. So we really saw that model of neoliberal policymaking combined with, you know, also it must be said, combined with systemic racist policies, particularly around the criminalization of homelessness, really become kind of the model in New York City, which was the first, really the city where the modern mass homelessness crisis began and then spread throughout the rest of the country. You know, it's not so much about Eric Adams per se, although he certainly has done a terrible job as mayor around the issue of homelessness. It's that same model of, again, cutbacks on the things that we know work to solve the problem of homelessness, and then a just overemphasis, a kind of focusing on criminalization and the other and other sort of like racist and punitive policies that just make the lives of homeless and poor New Yorkers much harder.
Patrick, New York State Governor Kathy Hochul has blocked the settling of these homeless people outside of New York City. Talk about this, please, and talk about the former Governor Cuomo's record in as much as he's likely to become the next New York City mayor.
Governor Hochul has certainly also done, you know, little to nothing to address the real crisis of homelessness in the state. But I think it's worth talking about Andrew Cuomo. I mean, right now, the political polls, you know, put him ahead in the Democratic primary for our mayoral election this year. There's every, you know, every chance that he's going to get elected mayor this year. And we need to look at his record because he has actually been one of the architects of some of the worst of those neoliberal policies around homelessness and housing that I talked about. Going back to the early 1990s, he actually chaired a homelessness commission under the otherwise progressive mayor, David Dinkins, New York's first black mayor. And Cuomo came in with his own agenda in which he instilled these conservative right-wing ideas around homelessness that essentially blamed homeless people for their own homelessness, created this idea that homeless people were sort of broken, that they needed to be sort of like cured, and that we had to ration the little affordable housing assistance through the forms of housing vouchers or public housing or other kinds of subsidized housing, that we couldn't actually provide that to those people, that these people were sort of not housing ready, as the sort of term came to be seen. So going back again to the early 90s when Cuomo chaired that commission, he was later picked by Bill Clinton to be the head of the Federal Housing Agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, where he really instilled that model in the 1990s, and it's really continued ever since then, this sort of model that essentially blames homeless people for their own homelessness and absolutely ignores the wider context, the structural crisis of the loss of affordable housing, the fact that the housing affordability gap, the gap between the incomes of poor and working people and the cost of housing in the form of apartment rents, that gap is getting wider and wider, and the cutbacks in federal housing programs that began under Reagan and continued under his inheritors. So that model that Cuomo brought in place, and then as governor, it was the same story once again. You know, he cut back on the effective housing programs that we know to work. One thing in particular I would focus on is the fact that New York City and New York State actually had a successful record, one of the few kind of bright spots in this history, a successful record of creating a model of housing called supportive housing, which combines subsidized housing assistance with support services for homeless individuals and families who are living with mental illness or with other disabilities. That model of housing and that sort of accord between the city and state to create that kind of housing had started under David Dinkins and under Andrew Cuomo's father, Mario Cuomo, back in 1990. In a city-state agreement called the New York-New York Agreement, which led to dramatic reductions in homelessness, actually, on the streets of New York City in the mid-90s. Unfortunately, when Andrew Cuomo was later governor 10 years ago, and when the Bill de Blasio tried to renew that agreement, tried to get the city and the state to partner once again on creating that kind of housing, Cuomo did everything in his power to block that from happening. So once again, he has been a huge part of the problem in creating the current crisis that we have now.
Patrick, And speaking of that crisis, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that municipalities are allowed to disband the kinds of public encampments of the homeless that we see, even though there may not be any place in that municipality for people to take shelter. Governor Cuomo, a liberal in California, supports that, as do a number of other public officials since that Supreme Court ruling. What are your thoughts on this?
I wouldn't characterize Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, necessarily as a liberal. I think he's shown that he's actually pretty conservative. I mean, the issue there is a longstanding legal case called Grants Pass that had been found by the federal courts to, under the federal court rulings, had found that municipalities could not arrest homeless people for public camping or for sleeping out of doors if they didn't have sufficient shelter to provide to them. And that's that happens to be the case in almost every community in the United States. New York City, I would add, just parenthetically, is the one large city in this country that has a legal right to shelter, thanks to the work of advocacy organizations like the Coalition for the Homeless and the Legal Aid Society. So we do have that legal protection, but most other communities don't. There's not enough shelter for people. If they're out on the streets or sleeping in parks or sleeping out of doors, you know, they've got no other option. Courts had ruled that it was unconstitutional to arrest them simply because they didn't have shelter. Last year, the Supreme Court overturned those earlier court rulings and allowed for the criminalization of public homelessness, of unsheltered homelessness in a number of states, including California. But the bigger issue here really, as I said, is about this sort of model that we've seen that began in New York and has just been replicated around the country, that instead of dealing with the root problems of this crisis, which is housing, instead of doing that, cities over and over rely on their police departments and particularly on a punitive and racist policing strategy that sort of targets homeless people. Human Rights Watch, the human rights organization, did an analysis of policing of homelessness in California a few years ago, and the findings of their years-long field research and investigation were just staggering. I mean, it turns out that an enormous amount of the policing activity, literally of just the police work that occurs in Los Angeles, is simply about criminalizing and punishing homeless people. That's essentially what our police departments have become, is almost like a kind of a tool for the punishment of homeless people. And obviously, you know, numerous studies and just, you know, common sense and experience have shown us that once you start to do that to homeless people, it just makes the problem worse in the long haul. And frankly, also costs taxpayers more money, because it costs a lot of money to jail and imprison and, you know, and arrest homeless people. And that money would be much better spent and much more cheaply spent on housing solutions.
So, Patrick Marquis, here's the blockbuster question. What needs to be done? If you had your wish, what would you like to see accomplished?
Well, I think the real answer here is that the solutions to the problem of homelessness are no mystery and have been well known for a long time. For the majority of people, it's affordable housing assistance. You know, there have been a range of federal housing programs, government housing programs that have worked to address the problem of homelessness, whether it's rental vouchers that pay the gap between what a poor family or individual can afford, the private market, and the cost of that rental housing, whether it's public housing or social housing, the model of housing that we see in, you know, in other advanced capitalist countries. And then for people who are living with disabilities, you know, whether it be mental illness or whether it be behavioral health problems, that model I spoke of earlier of supportive housing, which combines subsidized housing assistance with support services, has absolutely been proven to work. And, you know, one version of that is the Housing First model, which essentially takes folks off the streets, puts them into apartments, and provides them with the support services that they need. And it's been shown to dramatically reduce homelessness in the cities where it's really been tried. Cities like as different as Houston and Salt Lake City have had remarkable success in reducing homelessness. I would also add that there is currently an absolutely right-wing Republican effort to attack those programs. One of the major proponents and one of the leaders of the attack on those Housing First programs is a guy named Joe Lonsdale, who's a billionaire supporter of Donald Trump and who has been pushing for the criminalization of homelessness in cities around the country, and also for the End of Housing First programs. But again, to get back to the solutions, we know from looking at other countries around the world, the other advanced capitalist countries, Western Europe, Canada, Japan, places that have real government housing programs, to say nothing of a real social safety net in the form of health insurance and, you know, real income assistance for people who are poor. We know in that those countries that the levels of homelessness are remarkably low. So we know that this works. We also know that it worked in the United States in the period after the New Deal. I mean, in the decades between World War II and the 1970s, there was remarkably little homelessness in the United States, not the mass homelessness that we've had since the late 70s, early 1980s, and that is really a product of these mistaken and failed neoliberal policies that we've had ever since.
Well then, Patrick, realistically, what are the prospects of ameliorating the homeless situation in the teeth of what we now have, a government by, for, and of the very rich?
I got to say, I wish I could sort of say we've got some hope on the horizon, but it is a pretty bleak situation now, you know, particularly with the current administration in Washington. I mean, the Trump administration's own budget proposal would have absolutely eliminated or completely dismantled many of the federal housing programs that are remaining in this country. I mean, we already have a situation now where only about one out of every five American households that is eligible just in terms of their income level for a federal housing program can actually access federal housing assistance, only one out of five. They would have dismantled that sort of meager safety net even more. The budget legislation that's passing through, that's sort of being negotiated in Congress now, would make further dramatic cutbacks to the SNAP program, what used to be called food stamps, or the basic food assistance program, to Medicaid, which provides health insurance to more than 70 million Americans. You know, we're looking at a really, you know, just a very bleak times now. I mean, I do think that there have been, if I had to point to any glimmers of hope, I'd say that there has been some really successful organizing efforts, and it really is going to come down to organizing, grassroots organizing by low-income Americans, by homeless and formerly homeless people, you know, moving these things through. We had some success here in New York in strengthening our rent regulation laws, which essentially preserve affordable housing for hundreds of thousands of tenants here in New York City. We had some success in, you know, in other states and other cities and pushing for more housing development. But these are kind of really around the edges of what has really been a backlash coming from D.C. And, you know, we need to be doing more organizing if we're going to make any real success.
Trump started out as a young man working for his father, keeping black veterans out of housing in Brooklyn that was built with public funds. How do you view Trump's record since then? He's the world's most powerful man, a billionaire real estate magnate, evidently lacking of any human empathy. So what do you think of him now?
Well, it's interesting you ask the question that way. I think the history of Trump's family and of his family's real estate company actually illustrates some of the distortions and the problems that we've seen coming out of the neoliberal turn in American politics. You know, as you said, his father, Fred Trump, had essentially built his wealth and built his real estate empire off of government housing assistance. You know, programs like financing from the Federal Housing Administration, loans, federal housing programs helped him to build, you know, tens of thousands of housing units in Coney Island and Queens and all these places. Now, what Fred Trump did with that was actually exploit those programs. There were multiple investigations, including congressional hearings, about the fact that he, you know, fraudulently exploited those programs. And as you said, even I think most kind of notably about the racist policies that he had and, you know, keeping out black applicants for apartments in the Coney Island projects and Justice Department investigation that resulted from that. His son, in contrast, when he took over the company, learned to exploit essentially the tax breaks and the sort of tax policies that got developed in the post-fiscal crisis era in New York City, when the city, instead of actually spending money on building housing, was actually providing tax breaks to developers in order to build developments. And that's what his son did. And he just absolutely exploited those tax breaks and, you know, much of the wealth that came from, you know, the sort of the post-1970s era, that sort of Donald Trump run era, really comes from an exploitation of those tax programs. And it's, again, evidence of how those programs really benefit the real estate industry far more than they do actually create affordable housing. But unfortunately, the city and the state and the federal government now rely way too much on tax breaks to create housing instead of actually building and creating that housing and targeting the subsidies to the poorest people, the people most in need. I mean, you know, again, I mean, we could go on and on about all the problems with Trump. I think it's probably evident to all your listeners what's going on there. I mean, he's been anti-homeless from the start in the mid-1990s when he was trying to develop his Riverside South housing, you know, apartment developments that line the Hudson River. He helped the city to basically throw out one of the last remaining encampments of homeless people who were sleeping on the west side, you know, and he justified it and claimed it's something that had to be done for the betterment of the city. I mean, he's been involved in this all along, and it's obvious that he, you know, really has no, you know, doesn't care about homelessness at all, except to, you know, use it as a sort of a political rhetorical tool, which he did in the, you know, the last couple of election cycles, where he basically blamed Democratic cities for having all this homelessness, when clearly the real issue is the lack of federal housing support to address this problem.
Well, Patrick, you used to be the director, as we mentioned earlier, of advocacy for the Coalition for the Homeless. Tell us a bit about that organization, what it does, and how people who are listening who might need its services could be in touch with it.
Yeah, so the Coalition for the Homeless was the sort of the first major advocacy organization, founded by a brilliant anthropologist named Kim Hopper, a brilliant social worker named Ellen Baxter, and an attorney named Robert Hayes. They began working together in the late 70s when the modern homelessness crisis was first emerging. In 1979, Hayes brought a landmark lawsuit called Callahan v. Carey. The lead plaintiff was a homeless man, a homeless veteran named Robert Callahan. And they argued that under the New York State Constitution and a provision of the New York State Constitution that dated to the Great Depression, that said that the aid and care of the needy are a matter of public concern, he argued that there should be a legal right to shelter for homeless men. And in 1981, after years of litigation, they were able to reach a settlement, a consent decree, that established the first legal right to shelter for homeless people in the United States. That right to shelter was later extended in the early 1980s to homeless women and to homeless families with children. And it's the reason why in New York City right now, even though, as we said earlier, we've got upwards of 125,000 people who are homeless each night, around 95% of them are in shelter. And if you look around the rest of the country, that's simply not the case. In fact, the federal government just last year released an estimate of the number of homeless people sleeping each night. They say it's just over 770,000 people. That's probably an undercount. The number is probably higher than that. But of that 770,000 people, 250,000 are unsheltered. So the right to shelter has been a critical part of the mission of Coalition for the Homeless for these past going on 40 years. We've had to fight attempts to undo the right to shelter that were led by Rudy Giuliani, by Michael Bloomberg, by Eric Adams. The group has done an amazing job in fighting those battles, but also fighting for the real solutions, particularly the housing-based solutions that we need. And so, you know, the work continues. They, in addition to the advocacy work and the policy work, they also provide direct services that help thousands of people every day, from feeding people on the streets to providing housing and job training and a host of other important services. So, you know, definitely people can visit coalitionforthehomeless.org to find out more and to find out how they can help out.
For those listeners who are not familiar, we're speaking with Patrick Marquis about homelessness. This is your co-host, Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner. Are there any effective projects going on today across the country that you would like our listeners to know about?
I mentioned earlier the model of housing called Housing First, which really provides, you know, subsidized housing with support services for homeless folks who are on the streets, takes them right off the streets and, you know, puts them into that housing. You know, what we found is not only is that incredibly effective and incredibly successful in getting those folks out of homelessness, as I said also earlier, it saves taxpayer money. I mean, there was a sort of a well-known article in the New Yorker from a number of years ago called Million Dollar Murray, which sort of tracked the history of a guy who had experienced homelessness off and on for years in Las Vegas. This was a guy who had ended up costing the taxpayers of that county and that community $1 million because they kept shuttling him between jails and prisons and shelters and all of that. And when they actually provided him with an apartment with social services, it was much cheaper and his life was a lot better. And that's how we should be thinking about this problem. It's not only just a matter of doing the right thing. It actually, at the end of the day, costs a lot more money to do the wrong thing. This model that we have sort of had cemented in this country for 40 plus years of criminalizing the problem of homelessness, of cutting back on housing and the effective solutions to the problem, of just cycling people through various forms of kind of institutional care from hospitals to jails to prisons to shelters and on and on and on, that sort of revolving door, not only doesn't solve the problem, it not only makes the problem worse, not only damages the lives of some of the most vulnerable people, it also just costs a lot of money. It's an incredibly costly way to be addressing this problem, and we should be using that money and investing it in the real solutions.
Now, Patrick, you're working on a new book, are you not, on homelessness? What is it called? Tell us, what is the main thesis of the book?
Yes, well, the book is called Placeless: Homelessness in the New Gilded Age. It'll be coming out in late autumn. It's an attempt to kind of take through historical analysis and through a discussion of some of my firsthand experiences in my years of working as a homeless advocate to kind of really drill down and analyze this problem and the sort of the causes of how we got into this crisis, looking, as I said, at the neoliberal policies, looking at systemic racism, and also looking at sort of changes in capitalism, in the sort of late stage capitalism that's resulted in some of the structural inequalities that have made this problem much worse. And also how homelessness really at the end of the day is almost the tip of the iceberg in terms of the sort of wider forms of displacement that have occurred over the last 4 or 5 decades. And so I hope if people are interested, the book will be coming out in the late autumn. It's called Placeless, and I hope people enjoy it.
Any final thoughts you'd like to share with us before we have to let you go?
Obviously, the times are bleak and the problem of homelessness is getting worse. But the important thing to remember is that this is a problem with real solutions that are absolutely achievable. We can do this. We need to be putting more of an effort into organizing, into pressuring every level of government to be doing more on this. It's a problem that's not going to solve itself. And it's also a problem where there are definite political interests on the right wing and in various sort of industries who are going to be fighting this. They don't want to see that. They want to keep housing as a commodity that's, you know, something that people can, you know, make profits off of, when we need to be seeing housing as a home, as a place for people that need it, and we need to be making it more available and more affordable.
Well, Patrick Marquis, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. This has been an enlightening discussion. We're grateful to have you as a guest. We'd like you to come back in the fall when your book comes out. Thanks again.
Well, thank you so much, Michael and Jim. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patrick.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
All across this country, academic freedom is under severe attack. Why? Because at colleges and universities, professors and students who, well, dare to speak out in defense of the Palestinian people and condemn Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinian people have been censored, disciplined, fired, deported, and even arrested. Universities are told who they can hire and what they can teach under the threat of the cutoff of grant monies. This is all so that in an ever more authoritarian country, centers of opposition can be brought into line as they were in Germany. And these attacks on academic freedom are not limited to actions by university administrators. They also include those by the federal government as well. Visiting scholars, adjuncts, and lecturers without tenure have had their contracts terminated or not been renewed. Some have had their classes suddenly canceled. Faculty members who espouse views contrary to official U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine have been criticized in ways that have, well, trampled on their reputations and hurt their careers. As an excuse for this present-day McCarthyism, college and university administrators and President Trump often claim their censorious actions are undertaken only on behalf of ensuring their Jewish students feel safe on campus and to fight the so-called anti-Semitic speech and actions taking place on campus. But there is a distinct lack of evidence to support their claimed motivation. And in fact, the largest pro-Palestinian actions on campuses are often organized by Jewish groups, such as Jewish Voice for Peace. So today, we've again invited a professor from the University of Michigan to join us. We're going to ask him about McCarthy-styled witch hunts against academic personnel and learn how federal law is being misused as a mechanism of political repression against academia. We'll discuss the role that controversy over slogans such as those condemning Zionism play in this new attack on academic freedom, and what strategies are best employed today by the opponents of Israel's war in Gaza against such attacks as the ever more deadly Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine continues. Our guest today is Professor Alan Wald, the H. Chandler Davis Collegiate Professor Emeritus at the University of Michigan, which I might add is my alma mater. Professor Wald has authored 9 books related to today's topic. He has been a socialist scholar since the 1960s and is currently an editor of Journal Against the Current, as well as a member of the editorial board of Science and Society. And Professor Wald was a founder of the University of Michigan's Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine Committee. Professor Alan Wald, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder. Well, Alan Wald, warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's great for you to invite me back.
Alan, as I stated in my introduction, faculty members at colleges and universities all across this country have been disciplined and fired. They've lost classes over statements they've made or protests perhaps they've attended condemning the Israeli-U.S. war in Palestine. And colleges and universities are being denied grant money normally received by some institutions at the behest of President Trump. Much has been happening at your school, the University of Michigan. So tell us about this, including the departure of the U of M president and the arrest, and I gather now dropping, of charges against protesting students at U of M.
Yeah, I'd like to begin by discussing these events close to home here at University of Michigan, because I think they fit within a framework of what's happening nationally, but in some ways there are a few things that are more positive. So ever since all that turmoil began at UM back in October 2023, a lot of UM community members have been uncomfortable with President Ono's behavior, and we've had the urge to tell him very politely, of course, you know, he should, quote, go to a warmer place, if you know what that expression means. Obviously, this sudden departure for the Sunshine State, well, that wasn't exactly what we had in mind. We're more likely referring to a certain work by Dante. But, you know, now that Ono has accepted the offer of president of the University of Florida, it's really quite fitting. And there's a lot you could unpack about this. You know, first of all, remember, Florida is a state where this Governor DeSantis, he's openly banned all the EDEI programs, DEI, remember, diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's, you know, a code word for everything that we think is intelligent and decent in the curriculum. And he's instead introduced his own what he calls a patriotic social studies program with legislation that says that all educational administrators have to review any course material that mentions Israeli, Palestinian, Zionist, among a lot of other terms. You know, they're following the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism that classifies a broad swath of criticism against Israel as some kind of discrimination against Jews. The Jewish Voice for Peace, which I'm a member of the academic council, we've put out a video of scholars openly defying that definition, which is available online. It's pretty good. You know, when he publicly announced this decision, it was a complete surprise for everybody here because it was the middle of the year. I mean, this guy's supposed to be working on his UM presidential duties. He's not been around so long. actually, he was out auditioning for this higher salary. They're going to pay him $3 million a year instead of the $1.5 million that University of Michigan was paying. He made some remarkable statements that I'll just mention here when he appeared to make his case as to why he should be hired as the president of the University of Florida. I'm just quote here from what's in the Chronicle of Higher Education. They say, "Turning a perceived weakness into a strength, Ono offered that he was uniquely qualified to weed out left-wing ideology from the university because he had seen firsthand, you know, at University of Michigan, how it takes root. Quote, if lasting change is the goal, Ono said, reformers need people like me who have seen dysfunction from the inside, people who understand how ideologies spread, how to evaluate them, how to reassess them, and yes, how to dismantle them. I'm coming in not to impose my vision, but to serve an institution whose vision is already clear." I mean, this sounds like the classic anti-communist conformer, you know, people like Kessler and Whitaker Chambers. They said, you know, only people who have been communists can explain how bad it is. And of course, Ono had done a complete turnabout. When he was hired at UM, he said he was for DEI, for diversity, you know, for all these good things. And then as the political climate began to change, you know, he switched sides and then, of course, abolished DEI here and drove out the, you know, highly qualified faculty in charge of it, one of whom's left the university. So, you know, as they say, the fish rots from the head. There's a lot of disturbing things about Ono and his behavior. There's an article in a Chronicle of Higher Education by a UM professor on back on May 5th called Santa Ono Flees for Florida. Sylvia Maria Wynock, she's very good, and you should read that article for details. Two things I want to mention that are really interesting about this is that I think resistance played a role in driving him out, because the faculty was mobilized, especially around his DEI issue. They're not so great on some other issues, but on DEI, the faculty had held several meetings where they had voted to oppose his abolition of DEI. And in fact, the faculty senate had passed five motions back on, I think it was April 17th. By an overwhelming majority, the faculty senate voted to restore DEI, to defend international students, to honor shared governance, and so on. This was an element that made him decide that he's got to get out of here and change his total political outlook to do so. The second important thing, of course, as you mentioned, is the victory that UM student and staff members had in regard to the arrests last year. People had participated in a number of different protests. They were, you know, charged with felonies, and they were on trial here. And then suddenly, the Michigan State Attorney General, a Democrat named Dana Nessel, it was inappropriate for her to take over the investigation. It's a local thing here. But she, at the behest of a certain region, according to The Guardian anyway, took over this investigation, was going to try all these students. And then suddenly she dismissed first the misdemeanor and felony charges going back to the encampment. We had an encampment of students here and it was broken up and students were arrested. And then she dismissed charges against three people. Actually, they were not technically students. They were arrested for participating in a protest on campus last fall. There's still some other issues pending here, especially regarding a Palestinian staff member who was never charged by the police but was nevertheless fired. But in both cases, the departure of Ono, the dropping of charges, I think the speaking out in a collective way by the faculty and the community around clearly expressed demands, you know, resulted in victories. And there's an article in Jacobin about UM recently pointing out that it was the mobilization of public pressure, public outrage. We reached the public on this. And I think that was much more effective than those small-scale provocations, you know, targeting property destruction that were originally the center of a lot of attention. You know, certain people, we don't know who they were, went to houses of regents and college administrators, broke windows, left things on their lawn, and so on. But it was the mass public protest that really won this. In truth, you know, these are free speech issues where we're not asking anybody to, you know, run out and throw themselves in front of cannon fire. We're just asking people to mobilize around clear demands, speak out, and show up at protests. And, you know, you can be victorious.
Well, that was really helpful for my understanding of the situation, Alan. I want to ask you about the Trump administration at Harvard. Trump, you know, is seeking to exert extraordinary influence over American universities in general, and is doing this by withholding the financial support that's flowed to college campuses in the past for decades. Some have fought back, some have caved. Harvard is cited as an example of a university that has fought back. But you contend that even Harvard is weakening in its fight back effort. Please talk about what's going on at Harvard.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky. You have to read the statements and articles carefully. So on the one hand, Harvard is the most courageous institution because it's filed these lawsuits and it's unifying people around the lawsuits saying that the demands of the Trump administration, you know, they're cutting, they're demanding complete control of the university in effect, and are threatening or have already cut off a huge amount of funding and trying to keep international students from attending. And of course, these lawsuits are very important, and we support all this, you know, like 100,000%. But there's something wrong with the moral compass of this leadership at Harvard and many of the people around them. I think they've really been severely compromised on how they handle this because they made a big concession. They did this massive report, 300 pages, I don't know whether you get through it, claiming to document all the anti-Semitism at Harvard for 100 years and came up with a claim, which, you know, if you read it, you won't find much evidence that, you know, there's been a problem of this rampant anti-Semitism at Harvard and so on, and a real concern about Jewish safety. Although they say, well, they'll take care of it, you know, that they don't need Trump to take care of it, they'll take care of it and so on. But they made that concession. And of course, that's the underpinning of the whole war against the university, not just Harvard, but all universities, not just the Palestine protest movement. You can't make any claim about substantial, massive, or threatening anti-Semitism unless you claim that the protests and perhaps some of the aggressive behavior and the protests against the Israeli state are somehow anti-Semitic. That's the only way you can reach that conclusion. So once you agree that there's a big problem with anti-Semitism, you're essentially attacking the anti-genocide protesters. That's a big concession to make. It undermines their whole argument. And of course, what Trump is really after here is that if you follow his statements, his tweets, and so on, you know, this is about white supremacy in the end. He wants to get rid of anything that's critical of the U.S. around race. And, you know, you can see in his tweets where he's claiming that these radical left bird brain lunatics are, you know, in charge of the universities and so on. You can see he's attacking universities in the blue states. He's attacking universities with the largest Jewish composition of students and faculty, the universities that have a cosmopolitan culture that has always protected Jews. And, of course, Trump has allied with all these neo-Nazi types and these Holocaust deniers and so on. You know, in his campaign supposedly against anti-Semitism. They intended this 300-page Harvard report as a kind of a sop to Trump. You know, look, we'll agree with you about massive anti-Semitism, we'll take care of it, blah, blah, blah. Just please, please don't cut off our funding. But that's the basis of his argument. And of course, once they threw that blood in the water, as usual, the sharks attack more aggressively. And you know, the problem is that Harvard is kind of setting the pace. You know, you see more and more, especially the New York Times, you know, more and more people are saying, oh, yeah, wait a second. He's using anti-Semitism as an excuse to do all kinds of other terrible things. Well, you know, that's nice. But these people don't go so far as to say, and, you know, that's a big lie about anti-Semitism. It's not rampant. There may be problems on the campus. There may be some incidents, probably mostly right-wing, that are unpleasant and bad and maybe anti-Semitic. But it's not some rampant thing. The rampant thing is, of course, the protests, which are moral and justified and, you know, have to keep going. And if you know about the Project Esther, which the Heritage Foundation announced, this has, again, been covered in the Times, the Nation, and Jewish Voice for Peace put out a terrific critique. This is Trump's program for destroying the Palestine protests, and of course, going deeper into destroying any advances we've made against white supremacism and so on, by claiming that the protests are part of some kind of Hamas support network. That is, if you carry out a protest, well, you know, you're objectively hitting Hamas, aren't you? You're hurting U.S. support for Israel. You're hurting Israel's, you're undermining Israeli support, blah, blah, blah. So you're objectively helping Hamas. You're part of their network. It's the same argument we faced in the 60s around Vietnam. You know, Johnson and Nixon were claiming that the anti-war movement was orchestrated by communists, that the protests were objectively aiding North Vietnam and the NLF. It was part of a Vietnamese communist terror network and so on. You can't protest because you're aiding the other side. So, of course, anti-Semitism is real. There have probably been some incidents at Harvard, although in the report, or rather in his statements, President Garber says that, you know, anything involving physical threats is almost non-existent at Harvard. But, you know, it's real. If a person holds up a sign at a Barstool sports bar in Philadelphia that says, you know, F the Jews, even if they mean it as a joke, and I guess that's what's being claimed, it's still anti-Semitic. If somebody calls for the final solution against Israel, yeah, anti-Semitic. When J.D. Vance supports the Alternative for Germany party, that's anti-Semitic. And when Elon Musk says Germany must move beyond Nazi guilt and then makes jokes around Nazi salutes, you know, that's anti-Semitic and so on. And no doubt at every campus there are some anti-Semitic incidents. But if we believe scholarly research, it's mostly from the right. And of course, on some occasions, people on the left might say some things that sound anti-Semitic, but that's not the same as saying that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. A person can have another agenda for being critical of Zionism, but anti-Zionism itself is a critique of an ideology and a critique of a state policy. Just being anti-something, it doesn't tell you what the person is for, and that's important too.
Well, Alan, I wonder if you could talk to us about the case of Professor Ben Robbins in Indiana, and also about that denial of a diploma to the protesting student at NYU who dared to speak up.
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening on campuses. I read new things every day, but the two that I've been focusing on that are I think are particularly significant. Well, first of all, there's the Robinson case. So he's a professor of Germanic Studies, Indiana University, Bloomington. A recent law was passed, I think it was in March. It's called SEA 202. It's a dangerous new law that says a faculty member can be fired if there are anonymous complaints that they have squelched something called, quote, intellectual diversity in their teaching. Now, when this intellectual diversity has nothing to do with diversity, equity, and so on. This is another term that's invented for referring to, I think, basically right-wing conservative ideas. This accusation of squelching diversity came down originally on October 10th. A bias incident report was filed by a student. It used to be called the Office of Institutional Equity, but of course they've now banned the word equity, which means, you know, fair and just. That's a terrible word you can't use anymore. And they've changed the name to something like Office of Civil Rights Compliance. So the anonymous complaint was filed. And it was a year after this, Robinson had been very prominent as an activist critic of the war on Gaza. So this complaint leads, quote, this professor, this is an anonymous complaint by a student, so we're now like snitching on their professors. This professor has repeatedly spoken out against Indiana University on several occasions. It's clear to me he doesn't value this university. And then there's a reference to some in-class remarks that Robinson had supposedly made about his participation in a pro-Palestinian rally. Quote, he has used class time to say the university is restricting people's free speech. So in addition to this situation in Indiana, which I've briefly summarized, I just want to mention a case of Logan Rosos, who's a gay black trans man at New York University who was giving the commencement address at the Gallatin School graduation ceremony. And he tried to tell the truth about Gaza. And he had his diploma withheld by the administration. They're saying he spoke words that had not been pre-approved. So, you know, what does it mean for the Gallatin or for the university, NYU, to not permit him to speak words unless they're pre-approved? It seems to me that that's a question of invoking a kind of prior restraint, you know, which the First Amendment addresses. You can't suppress information in advance. That's censorship. It's clear that they wouldn't have approved anything that he wanted to say about Gaza. So I guess he did surprise them. But this is another outrage. And similar things are happening at other campuses right now because graduations are taking place. So this is a kind of the current phase of the student struggle.
Alan, there has been, sadly, just in recent days, been a deadly attack on those two workers at the Jewish embassy that took place near a Jewish museum in Washington, D.C., and it resulted in the tragic death of both of those workers. The culprit shouted "Free Palestine" as he was arrested. Now, many pro-Palestinian protest groups have already expressed their outrage at these tragic killings. But, Alan, I wonder, do you not fear that this hideous act will prove to be bad news for the pro-Palestinian movement in America?
This was a brutal and uncalled-for targeted killing that occurred on May 21st, Yaron Yasinski and Sarah Milgram. But it's a super hot topic, and immediately people are screaming, anti-Semitism, Well, you know, something can be just brutal and terrible and counterproductive and awful without necessarily being anti-Semitic. I mean, why that has to be the main thing you have to say in order to criticize it or respond to it is, it just shows that people are using this anti-Semitism thing to avoid complicated issues. And this is complicated, and I have some ethical problems even by emphasizing that today, because, you know, the context is that a lot of other people are being killed, and we're focusing on these two rather than the mass murders of Palestinians that were going on before and after. You know, on the same day, it's been reported that 82 people were killed in Gaza, probably 500 during that week, and there are just lots of terrible things that happened to people that, you know, deserve just as much attention. I mean, there were the 9 children of Ala Najir, the pediatric nurse, who the children were burned to death from an Israeli bombing just last Friday. And the Guardian had a feature on the 11-year-old Yakim Hamad, whose body was blown apart that same night in some Israeli airstrikes at a house in central Gaza. So I feel uncomfortable devoting a lot of time to these two particular deaths, terrible as they are, but there are two reasons why I think we have to focus upon Elias Rodriguez, the man who pulled the trigger. First, because the incident's being weaponized, it's supposedly proof that the slogans of the pro-Palestinian movement, especially Free Palestine and Globalize the Intifada, that these are supposedly anti-Semitic calls to murder Jews, and that these slogans incited the killing. And the second is because if you read the manifesto that he left, Rodriguez, which has been online quite a bit, he makes a number of statements that are really misleading for any kind of movement building for people who do want to build a mass movement to stop this horror. I'm not saying I'm an expert on this topic, but I've been following the reports and information. I don't see any evidence indicating that Elias Rodriguez has any kind of history of anti-Semitism or that he was motivated by Jew hatred. We have access now to 1,000 tweets that he made to friends and postings and so on. And, you know, something could come up in the future showing, yeah, he was anti-Semitic and that, you know, that would change our thinking. But at the moment, there's nothing to indicate that his views, his subjectivity was anti-Semitic. He wanted to kill a lot of Jews or something like that. In addition, it's said that he had a brief connection to one organization, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. That was a brief one. It seems to have happened years ago. He seems to have in these tweets a hostile attitude toward them. So, you know, if they're attacked, we should definitely defend them. I don't like this particular group very much, but I don't see them as anti-Semitic. I think the best explanation that we have so far on the evidence I've seen is that this was a person who was politically and emotionally unhinged by the horror of the genocide, which is just like a number of people in the 60s who were, you know, driven over the edge by the barbarity of the U.S. war on Vietnam and by domestic racism. You know, remember back then there was a targeted assassination by the Symbionese Liberation Army. There was the killing of innocent security guards by the Black Liberation Army. There was the blowing up of a building in Madison that killed a worker. There were the weathermen blew up their own. So, you know, this kind of thing has happened before. Now, according to the public statement that we now have by him, all of the horror of Gaza led him to some pretty familiar ultra-left conclusions. These are my views of what's ultra-left, of course. He believed that this action was going to find some kind of popular support. He said if he'd done this back a few years ago, people would think he was crazy. But now that the Zionism has shown its true face and so on, he believed that it would be seen as a sane action. And he also says that, quote, the abettors of Israel have forfeited their humanity. Now, he's talking here about using some kind of violent action and so on. Well, both these positions are problematic. You know, what is the consciousness here of the population? Does he really think that it's going to be met with anything but horror, that people are going to think this is sane? I think it's more likely that people are going to be revolted by what he did and believe the worst about the Palestinian protests.
Well, Professor Wald, sadly, we are out of time. I wonder, before we let you go, what might you refer our listeners to by way of further readings of your writings or of anything else that you think would be helpful to our listeners in this regard?
Well, first of all, around this issue of Palestine, I'm very active in Jewish Voice for Peace, as I've indicated. I'm a member of the Academic Council, so you should follow The Wire, where many of our statements are published. And the I mentioned a number of materials, the report that we issued where we defied the International Holocaust Remembrance definition publicly and other things. I also write articles for left-wing journals, and especially on Palestine. I've been writing for Against the Current, where we publish a lot of material on the situation in there, especially the writings of David Finkel, who is one of our chief editors, are very valuable. And beyond that, you should follow Jewish Currents. You should follow 972. You should follow Al Jazeera. You should follow Mondo Weiss. There are a lot of great publications. Merrick Reports is another one. The London Review of Books. New Left Review publishes a lot of good stuff. International Viewpoint has good stuff. There's a lot of material out there that can help educate you. And one thing to remember is that when they call you an anti-Semite, and, you know, that happens, I get called an anti-Semite and so on, remember, they're doing that because they don't have good arguments. If they could refute the arguments with facts and say, you know, look, your interpretation of what's going on is wrong for this reason, that reason, they do it. But they call you an anti-Semite because they can't defend themselves. They know it. That's a way out of it. So when they do that, smile, laugh, and know and be confident that we have the correct analysis.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.